yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we were off last week, but we're back again. And the topic I want to talk about today is California's public bank announcement. I also want to talk about the latest indicators this past week on the U.S. economy. As I've been predicting, Chessmen is falling after another here, slowly, but the drift is undeniable where we're going. Just a question how fast. And then I also want to talk about Ukraine Gate, Trump and the decline of American democracy, if we have time here to get to it, which I hope we do. Okay, let's start with some of the latest indicators on the U.S. economy. Well, you know, the beginning of the week here, we had the big shocker, and that is not so shocking. It was inevitable, but the U.S. Manufacturing sector is contracting. There's this indicator called the Purchasing Managers Index. In other words, purchasing managers who buy physical stuff for their companies and for sale, retail, etc., are surveyed every month, and an index is created from it, a statistic called the PMI, Purchasing Managers Index. And this is not only in the U.S., but globally as well. And the index for manufacturing, of course, shows contraction. Contraction meaning that manufacturing spending is contracting. And by the way, these indicators are regional as well, so you may have the Midwest or the North Atlantic contracting faster than the South, whatever, but there's a aggregate PMI, and that aggregate PMI came in, I think, 47. And anything below 50 on the index indicates a contraction. In other words, the sector is not expanding, it's actually going the other way. Production is being reduced. And of course, if that goes on for any length of time, you start getting layoffs. Right. Okay, so what we've got is a PMI now below 50, and well below 50, by the way. And what that means is the U.S. has simply joined the global manufacturing recession that has already hit other economies, including China and Europe, especially Germany, you know, the big manufacturing center in Europe, Germany. And that, of course, is all of that is before we even get a Brexit over there and before, any other financial instability events erupt, either in Italy or German banks. So it's a global manufacturing recession, and the U.S. has now joined it. Okay, so, all right, but, you know, manufacturing is, what, 10, 12% of the U.S. economy, GDP. It's mostly a services economy, and services are less volatile, and they rarely lead a downturn into a recession. They typically follow manufacturing and or construction, even more volatile in manufacturing, typically precede the weakening of the service economy. But a real scary figure just came out here for September, and that is the services sector PMI, Purchasing Manager Index, slowed dramatically. Was 56.4, well above 50, in August. Well, it declined to 52.6 In September. That's a very large shift for an indicator that generally does not move that much, that quickly. And it kind of portends the service sector now is catching the disease. There's an independent service sector estimator called the IHS Market, private source, but that is even weaker at 50.9. So in other words, what we've got here is the slowdown. Construction, by the way, last six quarters has been in contraction. What we got is a slowdown now, not just construction, manufacturing, but it certainly is spilling over by indicators to the services sector. Business investment in the form of factory orders contracted 0.5% in September. What about employment? Well, the job numbers came out today, and they were about what is necessary. I think it's 136,000, establishment survey, which is not quite a survey. It's really based on about 400,000 larger enterprises, corporations sending in their employment data. It's not the survey that estimates unemployment. That's the population survey. That's a true survey. It's 60,000 every month, households. But very clearly, you're looking at the job creation the last 4 months. You know, it's been up and down, but on a lower level. In other words, about half of the jobs per month are being created now that were being created a year ago. So what we see in the employment sector is it's beginning to have a penetration there. Jobs always lag the other indicators significantly, sometimes by as much as 6 months. So what we're seeing is the early signs, I believe, of the slowdown in services and manufacturing construction beginning to spill over into job creation. And as I've always argued here on the show, that I believe most of the jobs being created are part-time temp kind of jobs. And that, of course, has an effect on wage growth, because those wages are much lower. What's happening is slowly, secularly, structurally, the U.S. economy is shedding full-time permanent jobs and replacing them with part-time temp gig jobs. That's a slow-rolling process going on, particularly as older people who tend to have employment in full-time employment, at least up to 65. Those who have come back into the labor force older than 65, of course, are coming back as part-time and temp workers. And as those full-time jobs sort of roll off the economy, businesses are hiring more part-time temp. You can see that in the fight going on with the General Motors and the UAW. You know, the big issue, one of the big couple issues there is the temp workers. Manufacturing has really transitioned to this temporary part-time structure in the labor markets. And they've hired millions of workers, not just GM, of course, manufacturing in general, on a part-time temp basis. And, of course, paying them about half of what they pay regular full-time workers. And that's one of the big issues in the GM strike. The union and workers want to end that two-tier, two forms of economic citizenship that is permeating the U.S. economy now, not just in services. And by the way, that's true everywhere. Even in Europe, it's even worse. Statistics I've seen about part-time temp hiring, 60, 70, even more percent of all the new hires are part-time temp, especially in places like Italy and even in France and to some extent in Germany as well. New phenomenon. Capitalists everywhere, you know, they've manipulated the labor markets and the labor laws and weaken the union sufficiently so that they're able, you know, for recent decades, hire mostly part-time temp workers. Yeah, go look at the labor statistics. You see full-time employment declining, and at the same time, you see part-time jobs are increasing. Okay. All right, so let's continue here now and see where we are in terms of the economy. Eurozone, of course, is flat. Germany, if you look at the services PMI there, 51, manufacturing below 50. So, you know, what's going on in the U.S. is very similar to what's going on in Germany and Europe, or vice versa, if you want to put it that way. Right? The Eurozone economy is flat overall, and services PMIs are slowing everywhere. Globally, of course, business investment is contracting in many cases, not just in the U.S., and that's being exacerbated and accelerated by the Trump trade war. I say accelerated, exacerbated, because fundamentally, it's the end of the capitalist business cycle. By the way, a very weak cycle since 2009 in terms of actual growth. The next time around, after another great recession, which is coming, the growth will probably be even more stagnant. So, you know, we see the capitalist economy slowing. Think about it long term. Think about it decades long. You know, we see it slowing in terms of its growth rate globally. And we're sort of like at the first stage of that general global slowdown. And in the 2020s and after, we will see it even slower, I believe. So that's a review of the jobs and the indicators here for the U.S. economy. Once again, to summarize, we got in the U.S. Manufacturing PMI contracting now. We have a big deceleration in services growth. It's almost stagnant. Some indications it is stagnant. We've got job growth half of what it was a year ago, and a lot of that is low-wage quality jobs. By the way, 136 jobs is just about what's needed to absorb new entrants into the labor force. Right. And, of course, the unemployment rate went down to 3.5 because you have more people who can't seem to find jobs or decent-paying jobs worth their time. So they drop out of the labor force. And if you have a decline in the labor force, you have a decline in the unemployment rate here as more people drop out. It looks like more people fewer people are unemployed, but actually they're not counting all of the unemployed, the jobless, because they're dropping out. All right. Let's move on to public banking. I want to talk about the pros and cons of public banking. By the way, I am a supporter of public banking, but unlike some who are promoting the idea, I do not see this as a panacea to the problems of the U.S. and global economy. There are pros for public banking, but there are cons as well. And I would like to talk about the pros and the cons. Well, California just announced here this past week it was going to propose a public bank, a California public bank, or make it easy for cities like San Francisco and others to initiate public banks. In the U.S., there's only one state that has a public bank. That's South Dakota, I believe, South or North Dakota. Right. And so why in a place like North Dakota, South Dakota, is there a public bank? You know, why did they create a public bank? Well, one of the reasons promoting public banks is that private banks just don't lend to the folks who need it. And I don't know the history and the origin of the Dakota Public Bank, but I suspect it was because a lot of smaller farmers and smaller businesses simply weren't able to get loans. It was not profitable enough for the private banks to lend to them. And by the way, profitability is a relative concept. Maybe there are profits the bank, private banks now I'm talking about, could achieve from lending to small businesses, small farmers. That's possible, you know, but it's relative to the even greater profits that private banks could get by lending to hedge funds and equity firms and multinational corporations. So it's relative. And banks, private banks, will go and lend where the greatest profits are. And the smaller businesses and consumers, households, don't get the loans that they may need. Well, a public bank could and does fill that gap. In other words, provide the money capital where it's socially needed, as well as where there is a profit, even if the profit is not as great. In other words, it favors smaller businesses, it favors households, consumers, it favors needs that the private banks simply don't go to, like low-income housing, or even mid-income housing development here in California, apartments, and so forth. We have a homeless and a housing crisis. We have a homeless crisis because we have a housing crisis. Most people don't have a place to live that they can afford. And we have a housing crisis because the construction, home construction, has been going to the high end, $1 million and above houses, because there's bigger profits there. It hasn't been going to provide housing that, you know, average working class people can afford. Where they do purchase homes, I'm, you know, just take Northern California, is they have to go way out in the Central Valley and drive 2 hours or more each way to get to work in the Bay Area. That's the only place they can afford, if they're working class, to purchase a home. Well, you know, that can be mitigated by a public bank. Public banks can lend to construction firms and companies smaller that will take a risk and accept lower rate of profit by building a middle income housing or even low income housing. So the big advantage is lending can be made where it's socially needed. Small farmers, others, you know, small farmers have a hard time getting loans. And of course they use working capital loans every season. And one of the reasons why we have 12,000 farms that went under last year is because they couldn't get the financing, you see. Okay. Probably doesn't happen in South Dakota where the public bank is, but that's an interesting number. Despite Trump's now almost $30 billion subsidizing the farm sector because of the trade war with China, we still have 12,000 family farms going under. The big agribusiness companies aren't going under. And by the way, they're getting the lion's share of that $30 billion from Trump. Okay. A public bank, you know, another pro argument with public bank is that it will re-inject the profits it has back into lending and into the community. Private banks don't do that. What do private banks do with their profits? And they've been very profitable since 2010. They were essentially all bailed out by 2010, and they kept getting, you know, zero interest loans from the central bank after that. Well, what did they do with all those profits? Well, they give it to the shareholders. And who are the shareholders? Wealthy 1% investors, or financial institutions like hedge funds, equity funds, and so forth. They're the big shareholders in the private banks. And the private banks give much of their profits back to these folks, their shareholders. How much this year? Well, just the, I think the five or the nine largest banks, I forget if it's five or nine, will be giving back $200 billion this year alone to their shareholders. $200 billion. Well, you know, that $200 billion, if you had a public bank, could be rolled over into more investments that create, you know, more real economic activity that require more hiring and therefore benefit all of society. That's a big difference, right? Or the public bank, by its charter and its mission, it would have to reinvest its profits, and that reinvestment would help the economy even more so and generate more demand for lending and loans. You see, it becomes a virtuous cycle. It would not go to the wealthiest 1%, their shareholders. It would go back into the economy. So, first of all, lending where it's needed, and the private banks won't lend because the profits aren't as great as that what they could get lending to hedge funds that speculate, you know, or companies that issue junk bonds, whatever. Also, an argument for public banking is that it's more financially stable. Financially stable. In other words, we saw how the big banks got into trouble, as they do periodically, you know, by lending, risky lending, by engaging in risky lending, risky projects, and when those projects go bust, well, then they have losses on their balance sheet, and to offset their losses, they hold on to their cash, the banks, the private banks, and they don't lend as a result. And what we saw in 2008-09 is one segment of the private banking system called the shadow banks. In other words, what kind of institutions in the shadow banks? Well, investment banks, private equity firms, insurance companies, which are really banks, right? Hedge funds, boutique banks, finance companies, the list goes on. These are called the shadow banks. Why are they shadow banks? Why do we use the word shadow? Because they're not really subject to the same regulatory oversight and controls by the government. The government has regulatory controls and oversight of what's called the commercial banking sector. That's what the, you know, all the legislation was about, Dodd-Frank, Volcker Rule, all that, since 2010. But the shadow banks are never really brought fully under control. And the shadow banks don't take deposits from you and me. You know, they don't want small depositors. That's for commercial banks. They don't really want it either, but they take it by law. But the shadow banks are only interested in getting money from very wealthy investors who are looking for high-yield returns and therefore demand the hedge funds and so forth to engage in more risky projects, risky investment, because that's where you get the big yield and return, you know, double-digit returns. But by taking big risks, when the economy turns down, those big risks become big losses. And then, of course, you lose money if you're one of these big investors, unless you get out early, which some of the smart ones do. Now, the problem is that the commercial banking system lends to the shadow banking system. There's bigger returns for the commercial banks instead of lending to mom-and-pop businesses and households and farmers and so forth. There's bigger returns by simply lending it to speculators. But when those speculators go bust, they drag down the commercial banks too, because the commercial banks loan to them. So the losses of the shadow banks become losses on the balance sheets of the commercial banks. And then the commercial banks freeze up and don't lend, and then what we got is the real economy that produces things and real services can't get loans, and what happens is we get a big contraction. That's the logic and the dynamic that occurred in 2008-09. It went from the shadow banking system to the commercial banking system. Remember the collapse of Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Fannie Freddie, all that? Well, Washington Mutual, well, those were shadow banks, you see. But they then dragged down, well, AIG too, in big insurance company, derivative, risky derivative trading. They all collapsed first, but then they dragged down Citigroup and Bank of America and almost caused a collapse of the commercial banking system. If it wasn't for the government bailing out those two big private commercial banking institutions that were technically bankrupt and remained so for years until, you know, just 3 or 4 years ago, they finally climbed out. So the point here regarding public banks is that the public banks would be under popular control, in a sense, depends how it was structured, of course, political control and public control. That's why they're public banks. And they would not be allowed to invest in high-risk, potentially disastrous projects that cause a financial crash. And in fact, the private banking system, which would still exist in parallel to the public banks, you know, periodically always does go through these crises and contractions. Well, the public banks could keep the economy, the real economy, better afloat if they existed. They not only are not as financially unstable, but they could mitigate against financial instability events when they do occur. They could provide better services. You know, the private banks now everywhere are shutting down branches, forcing people to go online, which lets hackers find out everything about you in your finances. Yeah, they're shutting down branches, or they're leaving branches open with just ATM machines. You can't talk to a real person. You got to do it online. Then you got to sit forever and listen to somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about, and they send you on to somebody else who doesn't know what they're talking about, right? Yeah, that's the future. But it saves money for the Chases and the Wells Fargos, and of course that improves their profits. Okay, so you know, public banks could be more service-oriented, more customer-oriented. There could be more physical locations. You know, older folks don't like to use iPhones and do everything on the iPhone, right, for their banking. In fact, they're, you know, totally confused with that. So it would provide better service, better real service, especially in outlying areas where there aren't very many branches, rural areas and exurbs and so forth. All right, so that's kind of the list of the main advantages of public banking. Just to sum up again, one, lending where it's needed, but private banks won't go because the profits aren't as great. Recommitting the profits that are earned back into the economy, charging lower rates, you know, just to cost the money, or a fixed profitability level, more financially stable, can mitigate against instability, better services, and lending, counter-lending when the economy slows, like in a recession. Of course, all of this means that the private banks don't like it, you see, because it cuts into their business, takes away some of their business. Well, wait a minute. A minute ago, you said they don't want to lend there. No, but they don't want to create a precedent and let the government lend there and let the government be a competitor in its economic space. I mean, it's like the health insurance companies did not want a public option by the government because the government might be able to compete more efficiently. Of course, they say it's always inefficient, but that's not true. You know, that's just the cover, the ideological cover. Oftentimes, government can provide at less cost and more efficiently and more goods to more folks, more services to more folks than private sector can. But they keep up the ideology that only the private sector is efficient. You know, yeah, if it was so darn efficient, why do we get great recessions and depressions, right? Okay, so those are the pros of public banking. What are some of the cons? Well, here we get a little more theoretical, I guess. Look, What's the role of money in the economy? Money is the oil in the economic engine. Money allows and enables greater production and greater exchange of goods. Without money, we would not have as many things being produced or exchanged, bought and sold in markets. So it expands production. This was known by economists a long time ago. Adam Smith and others, way back. You know, what is the role of money? You know, what is money? Well, first of all, money is whatever people say it is, right? For decades, millennia, they said it was gold and silver, right? But it can be anything. It can be some other metal. It can be paper, you see. When we didn't have enough gold and silver and were able to expand production and trade in the 18th century beyond what was available in gold and silver to enable exchange, we created paper currency, and people accepted it. You know, for a while they said, oh, well, we got gold behind it, 100%. Well, we need even more money because we're expanding production and trade even more, and gold's not expanding. Therefore, let's say it's exchangeable currency for gold, a 1-to-2 instead of 1-to-1, and then 1-to-4. And then finally, in the 20th century, we get to a point and say, well, we need very, very little because everyone accepts the currency. And now we're getting to a point where paper currency is not even necessary. It's becoming all electronic, right? And people are accepting electronic transfer. Money is whatever people accept it to be. I mean, it could be seashells if you lived on a Pacific island, right? Or it could be stones or beads, or wampum, as they used to say, and all kinds of things. But when people don't accept it, then money becomes worthless. But money is basically about, you know, fueling the economic engine as it's needed. If it goes faster, well, you got to put more gas. Money is the gas in the engine, the oil in the engine. Now, money is not the only thing that determines whether the engine and the vehicle moves. Yes, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient by itself. Well, what determines whether businesses invest? Is it simply the cost of money, which we call the interest rate? Right? Is it the cost of money that determines investment? Right? Is it, if we lower interest rates, will that automatically mean more investment? Well, that's what the fake economists tell you, right? Especially those who are friends of banks, because, you know, the banks want low interest rates and businesses want low interest rates. But just because it's low doesn't mean they're going to invest. You know, what's called neoclassical economics peddles this fiction that if you lower the rate of interest, that will automatically cause an inverse increase in the rate of business investment. You know, lower interest rates, higher investment. Now, well, what determines lower interest rates? Well, it's supply and demand, because interest rates are just the price of money. That's all. The price of the good called money. So supply, increase the money supply, you're going to lower the interest rate. And therefore, it stimulates investment, so theory says. Well, wait a minute, there's a thing called demand as well, not just the supply affecting the price. Well, what about money demand? Raise or lower money demand, that's going to affect the interest rate, isn't it? Because supply and demand determine the interest rate, not just supply of money, but the demand for money. Well, what determines the demand for money? The general condition of the economy. You see, banks and central banks have very little control over money demand. They have some control over money supply because it's the banks and the central banks that really determine the supply of money in a closed economy, like global economy, not so much. But that's another point. Okay, so those who argue that lower interest rates will stimulate investment are really saying, well, increase the supply of money to lower interest rate to stimulate investment. It's a money supply theory that ignores the counter effects of money demand. My point is this. Whether it's a private bank or a public bank, you can make more loans available by lowering interest rate, but that doesn't necessarily mean businesses or consumers will borrow even at the low interest rate. Could even be zero. Well, wait a minute. If money is virtually free, why wouldn't I want to borrow that as a business? Get free money? Why wouldn't I? Well, because your profit is not determined by the cost of money alone. It's not even determined by the cost of business alone. It's determined by whether you think you can make a profit, i.e. sell more to people to buy your stuff. If people aren't ready to buy or not inclined to buy, or even businesses, buying from businesses, not just consumers, if they're not going to borrow. So it doesn't matter how much money and how cheap you make loans available. Lending will not occur, not because the banks aren't ready to lend. It won't occur because no one wants to borrow, because economic conditions aren't very good. See, it's the expectations of profitability, particularly in a downturn or a weak economy, that drive investment and consumption more than the availability of money. Now, to get back to public banking, you see, that's a problem for private banks and public banks. You can lead the horse to water, but if he doesn't want to drink, then he's not going to drink. You can make all the loans available, whether you're a private or public bank, but if folks are afraid to borrow because they know they have to pay it back, you see, even if there's no interest rate, they still got to pay back the principal, they're not going to borrow it from you. I guess what I'm saying is that there's a tendency to overrate monetary policy and money itself as the key to economic growth. There's a bias, both in economic theory and in political policy, towards monetary policy. Well, you know, that's what this whole thing was called QE, quantitative easing, with the central bank. What did the central bank do? It pumped in over $5 trillion after 2009 into the banks, you know, commercial banks that then loaned to the shadow banks that then loaned to multinational corporations doing business offshore, but they didn't loan, of course, that much to mom-and-pop businesses. That's why we had such one of the reasons we had such a stagnant, slow recovery. Well, why didn't they lend? Well, partly because they wanted to lend to the rich and redistribute it in shareholders and buybacks and dividends, partly. But partly because, you know, they didn't see, you know, 3, 4, 5% profit as worth their time and effort. And if you're not doing well as a small business, you know, are you going to borrow more? You're going to reduce your costs, and that includes the cost of money. Okay, so the point here is that money is not a panacea. Whether the lending is from a public bank or a private bank, there's no guarantee here, as we saw with QE, quantitative easing, that making more money and loans available is the answer to a chronic slow growth, slow recovery, weak recovery. Now, even that's fading. No. By the way, that same theory can be leveled against modern money theory, MMT. That same critique, rather. There's a tendency now on the left to replicate the policy on the right, you know, QE is really a policy benefits the banks and big companies. And most of that money went into financial markets or offshore. Therefore, it did not stimulate the U.S. economy. And they're about to do that again, you know. QE is coming again. Well, it's already here, right? They're creating what's called a permanent lending facility for repurchase agreements, repos, which is just another way of putting money into the big banks. That's all it is. That's a QE turned on its head. The repo market permanent facility. And by the way, you know, we had this crisis a couple of weeks ago in the repo market where banks lend to each other overnight using treasury securities as collateral. Almost collapsed once again. And, you know, the Federal Reserve has been pumping in $75 billion at a crack every week and probably is continuing through October here. Middle of October, you know, I suspect they'll pump at least $400 billion into the repo market to try to keep the banks flush with liquidity money. Yeah, and we'll see what happens here when we get a slowdown in the economy, either at the end of December every quarter or at the end of March, what's going to happen to the repo market and how much more they're going to have to pump in. It's QE by another name, you see. That's what it is. It's QE turned on its head, QE by another name. Well, MMT is kind of the same thing. The only difference with MMT, as I understand it at this point, I'm still doing my research and thinking about it. The only difference with MMT is the money might be going to fund infrastructure and other projects, you see. But it's still creating money, extra money. Well, the demand for those projects are still there, so that's another thing that's different than private for-profit enterprises. Won't borrow money even though it's super cheap because they don't see the profitability there. Well, if you got a government that's creating liquidity, MMT through the central bank, and then spending that on government projects, well, you're creating your demand. See, you're not depending on profit for it. You're creating the demand at one level at least. There still has to be a need, of course, ultimately for upgrading the infrastructure, which, of course, there is. So, you know, MMT might work for public infrastructure projects. But then the question is, well, why do you have to go that route? You know, Congress, come on, step up and do some spending. Well, if they spend, then they've got the budget deficit gets worse and the national debt rises. And, of course, that's politically hard for them to do. So you just do it by printing the money through MMT, you see. And then people don't know what's really going on, that you're raising debt, a parallel national debt, you know, in the Treasury Federal Reserve accounts. Well, you know, you could say you're not raising the national debt, even though you are indirectly. But that gets you out of the public limelight, you see. Congressmen, politicians don't like that, to be in the limelight. Well, that's why they created a central bank, so the government didn't have to bail out the banks directly anymore like they did in 1907, the last time before the Fed was created in 1913. You know, the politicians had to bail it out. The U.S. Treasury emptied its treasury to bail out the banks in 1907-8. Well, that didn't go down so well and help fuel, you know, the progressive movement at the time, political movement. So they learned their lesson, and the big banks in 1913 created the Federal Reserve and ran it until the Depression, and then run it indirectly in the background ever since. Yeah. Central bank independence. Well, independence from whom? From the government or from the private banks? Well, I take up that issue in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, and also in an article for the World Financial Review that followed in 2018, I think, entitled Our Central Banks as We Know It Doomed, or something to that effect, won't survive mid-21st century. They're going to have to change, and they probably will. Okay, so the point here is that money is not a panacea, and monetary policy is not by itself the solution to low-growth capitalist crises. And that's true whether it's in the form of QE, or in the form of public banking, or in the form of modern monetary theory, MMT. All of these are different, right, left, and center solutions, monetary solutions. But it's not money by itself that generates growth. The classical economists used to call this the dichotomy of money proposition, right, or the neutrality of money proposition. They were all focused on what are the real causes of economic growth. The real causes being technology, machinery, growing markets, trade, exchange as a stimulus, right? And what they call division of labor. And then Marx picks that up and he says, oh yeah, division of labor for the purpose of exploitation of labor. He has that twist to it, you see. But all of the classical economists saw that there were real forces that really determined growth, not the amount of money. The amount of money had to continue to grow to enable those real forces to expand the economy and growth. But the real forces were, the size of your labor force, the skills of your labor force, the size of your capital stock, the quality of that capital stock, how efficient it was, and so forth, the amount of land and the fertility of the land and the other natural resources. And by land, I mean, not just farmed land, the surface of land, I mean what's under it, the minerals and so forth. Because growth is really nature plus man operating on nature and making products, because he's got sources of power to do it with now, i.e. the Industrial Revolution began that. All of a sudden, we saw, we can make lots of things, with steam power now and transforming, getting steam by digging up coal, and then transporting and making steel and railroads and so forth. I mean, those were the real things, and we can see that replicated, in the early 20th century with the new technologies and a new power called oil. And all the things that we started making in the early 20th century, all the new products and markets and so forth. And now we have another big wave, technology wave, technology and power, new, more efficient power, now alternative energy, eclipsing the fossil fuels. This is what determines growth. And when businesses see new opportunities given the new technologies to create new products and product lines, then the businesses say, let's get some money to finance this. And here come the banks providing the money. So it's not the money that drives the whole thing initially. It's the money that enables it once it gets going. And what's driving it is expectations of profitability that take precedence over the cost of money. The cost of money is just one factor in investment, one factor in the profit equation. There are other even bigger factors. And when you're in a recession, slow growth, and especially a depression, money is virtually, the interest rate is virtually irrelevant. Now, Keynes talked about that in the 1930s. But, of course, what they call Keynesian economics today is not Keynes. It's a bastardized form, a hybrid form of pre-Keynes that Keynes railed against. And they cherry-picked what they liked from him, and they threw out what they didn't, and that's what you got taught in your academic institutions. That's called Keynesian economics. It's not. Okay, so, I'll make a long story short. All these are arguments why public banking, as a variation on this money monetary policy theme with cousins like QE, right, and MMT and so forth there, depending whether you're on the left or right of the political, economic political spectrum, you see, money does not determine lending and economic growth in and of itself. You can't simply increase the money supply, drive interest rates lower, and get economic growth. Well, why is Trump demanding then that the Federal Reserve lower interest rates? Because he sees the economy slowing? No. Not the main reason. He's even said the main reason himself. Because the U.S. dollar is too high. You see, there is a correlation between interest rates, treasuries, and interest rates, and the value of the dollar. And the dollar is too high because the rest of the global economy is slowing faster than even the U.S. and all this money, dollar money, dollars, because we've been flooding the global economy with dollars for a half century or more. All this money is now flowing back into the U.S. for safety, safe haven. The dollar is a safe haven currency. Well, actually, treasuries are. And all the big investors and U.S. offshore investors are sending the money back to the U.S., converting their currencies that are falling in value because their economies are slowing, capital flight flowing back to the U.S. to invest in treasuries. Well, when it flows back, you got to buy dollars to invest in treasuries. So the demand for dollars goes up and the value of the dollar goes up. So Trump is saying to the Federal Reserve, lower interest rates, right, to slow this inflow from offshore of dollars back to the U.S. Slow the inflow, which will reduce the demand for dollars and reduce the value of the dollar vis-a-vis other currencies. Well, why is he saying that? Because he just likes the lower dollar? No, because his buddies, big multinational corporations who are now all around the world like never before. U.S. capitalism has expanded since the 80s tremendously offshore. U.S. capital. Well, if I'm doing business in Argentina and their currency collapsed 40%, I'm a U.S. multinational corporation in Argentina, let's say, and their currency's fallen 40%, and the dollar, you know, correspondingly has risen, I got to take my profits in Argentine pesos and spend even more of it to buy dollars that are more expensive if I want to send the money back. In other words, my profits get wiped out if I'm a multinational corporation doing business in Argentina. More than wiped out. And that's true just about everywhere else because the currencies everywhere else are falling as the dollar rises. So when Trump says, you know, look, Fed Chairman Powell, lower your interest rates. Damn it. You know, what he's really saying is, hey, you know, I'm getting a lot of feedback here from U.S. multinational capitalists who are really complaining about the dollar being too expensive, and they're losing their profits offshore. Well, Trump says, we'll come back then. And they said, no, we're not coming back. Well, you crazy? Donald, you're crazy. That's why it won't work, you see. You know, Donald is trying to buck the nature of 21st century capitalism. Well, maybe he's trying to sell the story to voters that he's trying to buck it. Or maybe he's just too dumb to really know what's really going on globally. That's a very strong possibility. But, you know, he wants the Fed to lower the dollar. And, of course, he just said, once again, you know, he spins the reality, saying, oh, I think we're going to get a deal with the Chinese here on the trade. Yeah. We'll see. It takes two to get a deal. but, as I said, he just may try to take the money and run on the table, the concessions the Chinese have put on the table already. He'll try to take that and forego the technology war, which is the real war behind the trade war. Next generation technologies, I've talked about that. That's what this is really about. You know, but it's an election. He's under pressure here with the impeachment. You know, he needs a win. So he just may take what's on the table, have a deal here, although I'm sure he'd prefer to do it closer to the election, and say, hey, look, I won. I did everything. And, of course, a lot of that will be spin and misrepresentation, and he will have not won on the tech issue. But, you know, we'll get the Chinese to buy more farm goods from Archer Daniel Midland's, and big banks, U.S. banks, can open up businesses more in China and keep the majority of their operations under the control, 51% or more ownership now. That's what Mnuchin wants for his banker buddies, you know, ex-Goldman Sachser himself, you know, and Midland America, you know, farmers and so forth. How long will they accept 30, 20 billion more in subsidies? They want a deal too. So he may go for it. Who knows, you know? I think eventually he will collapse his position and accept something and say it's everything when it'll be very little. All right. So we'll see what continues to happen there on the trade front. Well, we didn't get to talk about Iran, not Iran gate, that's what Reagan had, Ukraine gate, right? The impeachment and Ukraine conversation here and so forth and what it meant for possible impeachment, obstruction of justice going on. Well, this is a very interesting political thing going on that's going to influence all the economy as the economy influences it. And I do want to talk about Ukrainegate, Trump, and the decline of American democracy. But that's another show. And we'll take that up next week. And it's really the last chapter of my forthcoming book in a couple of weeks called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. And part of that analysis of neoliberal policies since 1980 concludes with a corresponding analysis of how the expansion of neoliberal policy requires and has required and continues to require the destruction of democracy in the U.S. The two are correlated, you see. So I'll talk about that next week and start a series of discussions on this show from my book as it comes out here, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, which will really be about how the new policy mix that's called neoliberalism has evolved over the last four decades, how it confronted a crisis in 2008 and 2009, hit a wall, how Obama could not put Humpty Dumpty back together again, and how Trump represents an attempt to reconstruct neoliberal policy in a new, virulent, aggressive form. And that's how you should understand policy under Trump. And behind this all is a restructuring of the U.S. economy that continues beyond the control of policymakers. So we'll talk about chapters in the book between now and its release in a couple of weeks here on this show. So next week, Ukraine gate, Trump, and the decline of American democracy.